I'm a licensed psychotherapist, and we're here to deal with mental health issues from a holistic perspective, which means finding some balance in our lives, body, mind, and spirit. We all know that the truth will set you free. The question we ask here is, how long are you willing to keep freedom on hold? And as we get into today's show, I know we're a week before Christmas and Hanukkah and Kwanzaa and all that stuff, and I just want to wish everybody a Merry Christmas, a Happy Hanukkah, a Happy Kwanzaa, and for those non-believers, just a happy life. And I want to start by reading a Ann Landers column that I've actually had for a couple of years, and it's written by Kay in Parkland, Florida, and she writes, "Dear Ann, in case your readers might want to know, male reindeer drop their antlers from late November to mid-December. Female reindeer retain their antlers until after they give birth in the spring. Therefore, Santa's reindeer are all pregnant females, including Rudolph. Please, Anne, let's set the record straight." I just thought everybody would like to know that, too. So Rudolph and Blitzen and all them are pregnant females delivering our gifts over the Christmas holiday. Now, today's topic is going to be a follow-up from a show that I did right after Hurricane Katrina. And today's topic is called The Truth About New Orleans, an update so we do not forget those people in the Katrina area who are still struggling and are still going through a lot. And if you've noticed that most of our newspapers, some of the articles about New Orleans and Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, that were all affected, very often now the articles are not on the front page. And recently there was an article about that titles, "Bush Seeks $1.5 Billion More to Bolster the Levees." Now, they have been asking, I think, for close to $50 million to really do the levees properly so they can withstand a hurricane, you know, a five-point hurricane. And they were asking for this long before the hurricane hit. Now we know that because of the weather patterns that we're likely to have strong hurricane seasons like this past one for possibly the next 10 years. And yet, they spend $60 billion and maybe more for relief, which didn't all get to where it needed to go, but they still won't give enough money to do these levees properly. So next year, when another hurricane at 4 or 5 hits New Orleans, and it's quite possible, you know, you can't play the averages anymore with these things, they're still not willing to put the proper amount of money into repairing these levees and getting New Orleans back up to where people feel safe moving back to their homes. It's like a domino effect. If you don't repair the levees, people won't feel safe to rebuild their homes. If they don't rebuild their homes, New Orleans won't get rebuilt. And if New Orleans doesn't get rebuilt, and the people that do the work and create the diversity in that community that was so full of life because of the diversity, then the whole tenor of New Orleans and Louisiana is going to be changed, and all those other cities that took in people from Hurricane Katrina are just going to have larger populations themselves with people not willing to return. Now, that's just a little piece of it. And my guest today was on my show with her husband about, I guess, a week or so after the hurricane. And you might recall many of us had a very difficult time tracking them down. And luckily, they were safe in Baton Rouge when we finally found them. And so Dr. Kira Mosley, who's a PhD from the School of Public Health and Tropical Medicine from Tulane University, is my guest today, who's going to give me an update, give all of us an update about what the realities are in New Orleans, as well as what she's doing to help rebuild and help heal emotionally and psychologically and spiritually the pain that's been caused throughout New Orleans. So, Kira, welcome to the show again.
Thank you.
What's your catch on what I said about the levees, and what's truly going on there from your perspective?
I think you're right on with what you were saying, particularly regarding the levee rebuild. I think one of the most difficult aspects for those of us that are back and trying to live and rebuild lives is that we are so completely overwhelmed. There's so many things that need to be done in terms of developing some type of infrastructure so people can come back, that I think people are absolutely spent and exhausted and overwhelmed. The response has been so slow, whether it's at the city level, whether it's the state, or whether it's the feds, and it's gotten to a point where the mental health effects have really started to take shape. A lot of people have just enormous amounts of bills due, and they can't pay them because they've lost their jobs. And
which is the case for you and Derek, as I understand. I mean, you're both out of work, and your mortgage company actually threatened to foreclose if you didn't start making payments again. Isn't that correct?
Correct. And some of my cell phones were shut off for lack of payment because one was stolen when they looted my house, and they ran up about a $2,000 bill, so we're fighting that. But it took a while to get the phones turned back on, and then the electric company finally getting us hooked up then turned it off for lack of payment. And so it's crazy in that we all have these four-month-old bills hitting, I mean, 4 months' worth of services, and none of us are in a position where we can really pay them, and predominantly that's because none of us have been able to settle with our insurance companies or the flood companies. And it's an exasperating catch-22. A lot of people, they can't move back because FEMA has not reacted fast enough to get trailers on the ground. I have one girlfriend, they finally dropped a trailer in at her house, hooked it all up, and had the door locked. And they said they wouldn't give her the key until a final inspection had come out to make sure the plumbing and electric had been hooked up properly. Well, that was like almost 3 weeks ago. And they told her she can't open it, have the lock change, because then she'd be tampering with federal property and she'd be arrested. I mean, it's just ludicrous. And in the meantime, she's staying in a home that's half of it had to be gutted, the whole first floor, with no power, and she has nowhere to stay. She has no job. You know, it's just crazy things like that.
Now, you and Derek and your little boy, Ethan, are back in your house. So a lot of people would say, well, at least you have a house to move back into. But I understand there are holes in the roof and the adjusters still haven't come out, so you still can't get that repaired. Your home was looted twice while you were evacuated, and a lot of your personal and valuable items were taken.
Right.
And all the other issues that you just mentioned are still going on. So it's like not fair to say that because certain middle class and upper class areas weren't destroyed, that things are easy for you. Is that correct?
Absolutely. The areas that were basically not touched or damaged were primarily wealthy areas. And those that happen to live in areas where there was some damage, if they had the resources and means, like other houses, or they had money in the bank to start repairs, then they're fine. Several people I know are not coming back until their contractors are done fixing their homes, but they have the luxury of being able to do that. The vast majority of New Orleans is your middle class, and that's predominantly African American, and that's the population that has just been reamed. It's been almost 4 months. They're coming in on their own trying to get a home with no support from the city, no help labor-wise. And they owe money on the property, but they can't move back into it yet, and they're having to cover their costs living somewhere else. It's a mess. I think one of the only things that holds people together right now is that we're all pretty much in the same boat. We each have a story. Our circumstances are different. People who've lost everything will laugh and say, well, I don't say they'll laugh, but have gotten to a point where they've said, well, at least it made the decisions easy for us. It decided it for us. And you know, we're just going to start over again.
You said something interesting, that the vast majority of the middle class were African Americans, and yet that's not really reported. Most of what's reported is that most of the African American community in New Orleans were on, state doles and things like that, and that they were, you know, the poorest people in New Orleans, not so much the middle class. So, you know, that seems to be stereotypically what's being reported about the African American community in New Orleans. And most of those lower class economically, their homes were totally destroyed. And now you're saying that the middle class in the African American community also lost a lot of their homes.
Right. Well, no, absolutely. The areas that were hit the hardest, where there were homeowners, were predominantly black. And a lot of those folks, there's no power back, there's no safe water, there's no gas service. Even if they wanted to come back, they can't. And yes, our poverty level as a state is higher than anywhere else in the United States. And per capita, New Orleans is only less than half a million people. It's about 475,000 people, at least before the hurricane. And yes, we did have a high rate of people that were living on social service programs, but that still was only about 20%. So you're extremely wealthy. Let's say I'm going to be generous and say 20%. That still leaves 60% of a city that was middle class. And it's these homeowners, the people that were didn't have extensive resources, but were working very hard, paying their taxes. They're basically the tax base of this entire region. And they've been displaced. They're not able to work here. I don't know how New Orleans is envisioning that they're going to get their tax base back. As much as wealthy people are sitting back and saying we get to redesign the city any way we want, it's going to be very interesting to see what they choose to do, because if you don't have a workforce and you don't have a tax base of people spending money and people to draw taxes from, how do you pay for anything?
And people to do the work for the tourist industry, which is one of the main industries there.
Right. Well, and shipbuilding. I mean, we have quite a few industries, and everybody is dying for laborers, but there's nowhere for them to live because they've not set up any of the homes where people can come back and be able to have somewhere to stay while they're, you know, working to get their life back. They have Burger King is starting at $10 an hour plus a $6,000 sign-on bonus.
A $6,000 sign-up bonus to work at Burger King.
Which comes out to about $30,000 a year plus full benefits.
Wow.
Right. And that's how desperately they need people to work here. They need people of all levels, calibers, experience, and background, from day laborers all the way up to, highly trained professionals. But they can't get the labor back in because they have nowhere to live. And one of my biggest grievances with FEMA is how hard was it to get trailers put into the front yards of people. And I think politically they've been very slow to get them in. There's no reason after 4 months they couldn't have trailers on every homeowner's property so that they do have somewhere to live while they're refurbishing their home and be able to work. So I don't get it. It's completely illogical, and all I can think is that it's the arrogance and it's the incompetence. And they're not looking 5 years down the road. And honestly, you cannot do economic development without the biggest asset of any area, and that's your people.
And then what I said earlier in terms of the levies, nobody's going to go back to those low-lying areas if they're not sure that it's not going to happen again next year when another hurricane hits New Orleans.
Right. Well, and it's real interesting to watch. Interesting is probably not the appropriate word because I go through a roller coaster of emotions every day, if not every couple of hours. But New Orleans was not the only parish that was hit. And there was about a million people region that was affected by this. And the parishes that got hit the hardest were Orleans, a parish called Jefferson Parish, about the same size as us, that kind of wraps around us, and an area called St. Bernard Parish. And St. Bernard was under 20 feet of water. And they have been completely left off the table. They received almost no press, no assistance. They evacuated their own people out. And one of my good friends is actually the chair of the city council down there, and I've already been down twice to visit with them. They had their entire parish submerged underwater. It was over the levees. And despite all that, they have done twice as much as New Orleans has done with rebuilding.
In what way? What do you mean?
They have FEMA trailers. Any citizen who wants to come back to that parish to restore their home, they have a FEMA trailer on the property. What I think happened is St. Bernard Parish has far better trained, better skilled, better bottom line leadership. You've got people that they've elected that are far more competent than what we're dealing with at our city and state level. And they also have done what is so viable in an incident like this, which is what Mississippi and Florida did. You leverage your resources. And when the Fed said that they weren't going to bring down FEMA trailers, the city council chair said, you know what, if you don't want to help, that's fine. We have a huge oil refinery here. We supply, I don't know, some crazy like 5 to 10% of the United States is oil. And they said, we have enough oil to last us generations over. We'll be happy to close our borders and not do business with you anymore. But if you want access to our oil, you will get the feds down here and you will start helping us get our citizens back.
Did it work?
Yes. And that's what Mississippi did, and that's what Florida did. So there's no reason, there is absolutely no reason for the type of rebuild crap that they're doing here. The other parishes are, like I said, they're head and shoulders above what New Orleans is doing. And I comprehensively understand what's happened and why it's happened the way it's happened. But it's, to me, one of the biggest atrocities I think I've ever seen in the United States.
Well, you're kind of inferring, I mean, because a lot of what I read in the newspapers in Los Angeles is the fact that it's really mostly FEMA. In fact, Governor Blanco, when she released all those emails and communications and stuff, really started to be seen in a more positive light, that she seemed to have done what she needed to do, and she didn't get the federal government response, and that the mayor, his hands are tied because, like you said, there's nothing for him to draw from within the city if he doesn't get state and federal help.
Right.
So what's the reality of, I mean, everybody's saying no blame game, but the truth is somebody knocked over the first domino and nobody's rebuilding.
Right.
Who was it?
Well, and that's, honestly, I think it was a complete breakdown across the board, personally. I think that it was... No one ever believed something like this was going to happen, is the bottom line. I'm like the only person I know who packed as if my house would be gone when I came back. And that's because of my public health background and training and being a Peace Corps volunteer. So that I knew it was going to be bad. I knew this was the big one, or at least the first big one to hit the United States. And I was one of the only people I know that literally packed as if our house would be gone when we came back. So I don't think anyone from the local to the national level really thought it was going to be that bad. I think the other...
In spite of the warnings that they've been getting from the professionals for years.
Yep.
It's not that they didn't think it would happen. They stayed in denial and didn't want to believe that it was going to happen.
Right. And one of the other issues you had was everyone wants to know why Nagin was so slow to not pull the trigger on the whole evacuation plan regarding our rapid transit buses and also the Amtrak trains, because that was part of the evacuation plan, but he never pulled the trigger to execute it. And now that some time's gone by, what he was dealing with was a lot of pressure of trying to make the right decision, because if he had pulled the trigger on that and it wasn't a bad event, then he would have been blamed for wasting a lot of time and resources that were expended to get everybody out and then get them all the way back. Because that happened about 3 years ago, where over 50% of the city evacuated. He opened the Superdome, and it was like riots. So I think part of why he was slow to respond was because he did not think it was going to be as hard as it was. And I don't know how much clarity there is on this, because I don't think the papers, obviously have done a good job of portraying everything that happened. But it wasn't the hurricane. The hurricane came on Sunday night, and it did its damage, predominantly wind and a little bit of flooding.
Your roof with all the holes in it that the justices haven't been by yet so you can repair.
Right. So that hit and left. On Monday, probably early afternoon, a lot of people were leaving or going and assessing damage in their area. That's when the first levee break happened. And it wasn't the 17th Street levee break. There were three levee breaks, and people don't seem to know that either. Two were breaks in the levee that they literally just broke down, and one of them was because a barge went into it, a barge that became loose while it was on Lake Pontchartrain, because we're surrounded by a huge lake, and that whipped into one of the levee ends, and it broke it there. So there were three breaks in the levee, and I think when the first one hit, it then impaired and what caused the second one, and then you had the barge on the 17th Street Canal one in the infamous Ninth Ward that everyone talks about and covers. So I don't think people understand that the vast amount of damage was done by the levee breaks. It wasn't the hurricane.
So it wasn't an act of nature. It was an act of man.
Well, it was a lack of not having the proper infrastructure and building up to code that should have been there. If you look at the Danish and what they've designed and done with their levee systems, there's no reason we should be so archaic. And that comes down to politics, local, state, and federal. Louisiana has been asking for that for a long time. The feds haven't wanted to put that money into it. We as a nation don't do prevention. We don't do it with health. We don't do it with our infrastructures. We don't do it with economics. We don't protect investments. And I think this is a perfect example of, because they didn't prevent this and they didn't put the $1 billion that probably needed to be put in to really get it shored up and up to shape, they're now looking at, I mean, I don't even want to think what this is, $50 billion? It's the outlay that they're going to have to do because they would not build the appropriate levees that should have been
there. Which I believe that was the amount they were asking for over the last few years in order to reinforce the levees properly.
Right.
But now they're going to have to do that for the recovery, and they're still going to have to spend that money sooner or later on the levies.
Yes and no. Hypothetically, logically, yes.
yeah.
Reality-wise, I don't think so. I know in New Orleans as well as I do, and knowing a lot of the key players politically and in the nonprofit community, et cetera, the mayor in New Orleans has done historically what they always do, and he's put together his advisory rebuild council, and it's the exact same people that are always on this. And it is a combination of lawyers, bankers, and real estate developers. That's it on his commission. There's one woman who's a supposedly community member, but she also is known as a complete sellout and took bribes when they took down one of the largest housing projects here and totally screwed her and her community. So if you look at who they've put on the commission, it's a joke. And they've done the same thing at the state level. It's a joke. It's the same old people that they're still in a planning phase. It's been 4 months, and they're still in a planning phase. And in the meantime, not only do people have nowhere to come back to, there is no free services on the ground here. Red Cross is virtually gone. I think they have two vans in our entire parish that are handing out hot meals. And let me tell you, their red beans and rice suck. They do not know how to cook. So Red Cross has got two trucks. I haven't seen Salvation Army. We have one or two tiny little grassroots clinics with some volunteers that have sprouted up, and that's virtually it. 25% of our population depended on the public health system to get their medical care and services, and those have been wiped out, and they're not looking to replace those anytime soon. So unless you have private insurance, unless you already have coverage, you're pretty much screwed right now.
Well, not only do they have nothing to come back to, but a lot of them, after 4 months, are beginning to settle into the communities that they've been sent to and may choose not to come back.
Absolutely. When they do, my assistant, who I had working with me for 2 years, she had a horrible, her mother passed away a week after they evacuated from the stress. And she came back last week for really the first time to work with me for about a week to help me get stuff organized. And we drove around, and we saw her husband's mother's house, and we saw the shed that her 8-month pregnant cousin was on top of for 4 days. And when she started to see some of the areas, what a lot of us get is just absolutely enraged. We're devastated, we're enraged, and it doesn't have to be this way. There's absolutely no excuse for it. And we keep saying, where is everyone? Where is that $2.3 billion that's been raised by organizations on our behalf? Because it's not here. They're not funding anything here on the ground. That alone is a huge outrage as well. And after I've challenged several of the large organizations, I've gotten to where I'm going underground and we're doing things quietly and just blowing out services because we can't wait any longer, and we're so disappointed, and there's so much despair and lack of hope, and just, like I said, absolute anger when you drive by places that, you know, your community, where you spent your time, where you went to school, and you see that it looks the same as it did a week after the hurricane, and there's no reason for it.
Now, I want to remind my listeners that we are live, and if you have some questions or comments for Kira Mosley or myself, the phone number is 480-949-1310. That's 480-949-1310, whether you're in the Phoenix area or whether you're listening via the Internet on our simulcast. I want to get a little closer in terms of how this has impacted you and Derek and Ethan, your son, in terms of, I know that at this point, the three of you have moved back into the house, even though there's still holes in the roof?
Yes, there's still holes. We don't have our, we don't have gas. We don't have our central air and heat. It's a little cold here right now. And we still haven't gotten a new refrigerator because the wood floor that our kitchen is on is still the damage, like, bedded into the flooring, so we have to go back and refloor it. And we just haven't had time. So, yeah, it's been a full-time job just trying to keep up with bill collectors and everything else. The other thing that's happened, which is not unique to my husband and I, my husband was offered a job and has taken it up at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, and he's been offered a much better position at a lot better pay. So
then he had a Tulane.
Correct.
Right.
And so he is leaving, he is moving up, but my son and I are staying here because we have two properties, both with damage, that it's probably going to take at least 6 months to get them up and running and rented and, you know, not so we're hemorrhaging financially.
Uh-huh.
And we just don't know. I've in the last few weeks, have actually received some grant awards from the federal government on a few things for the nonprofit that I run. So it's I can't really leave now, at least not right now. So we're going to have to separate for a while and just see how it goes. People say, how long will you until you go up? And we honestly can't answer that. For most of us, we can't plan more than a week in advance right now.
Mm-hmm. That's the next thing I want to get into because, I mean, I've known you for a long time, and I know that you're a doer and you're a visionary. And when you get an idea, you're one to follow through and make things happen. And you have a project called the Prometheus Group that is, in spite of everything, beginning to get up and running. And I'd like you to share with people, my listeners, what Prometheus Group is doing and why.
Okay. We actually established about a year and a half ago. And it was a group of women that were so frustrated by the complete lack of capacity in our nonprofit service providers. I've always said it's too little, too late, and we have hundreds of thousands of people that need care and services, and they weren't getting them, and no one was holding any of the nonprofits accountable. So we had made careers over the last 10, 20 years of doing nothing but working with nonprofits to make them better ones, whether it's through strategic planning or building their board of directors, writing grants for them, evaluating their programs, whatever aspect that was. We decided that we were tired of individual efforts, that we really wanted to form a community nonprofit that led by example, quite frankly. Louisiana has the weakest nonprofit sector in the United States. We draw down less money than any other state in the nation in grants and foundation money. There's no reason that we should not be able to get some things up and running. And we were so exasperated working externally that we decided we really just want to build our own nonprofit. And there were two main things we wanted to roll out. One part was continue to provide technical assistance to various nonprofits in getting them up to capacity. The second thing was the opening of a very large community arts center. The mental health piece is just phenomenal. It was already a huge issue in the state. The capacity was not there. Very few providers. Most of the providers are, I'm going to get hit for saying this, but not very evolved. Stuart, as you know, I just celebrated 15 years clean and sober, and I got clean and sober in California and growing up. And I've been in program probably over 20 years. So obviously, I had a little trouble that first 5 years hanging in there consistently, but I've got 15 years now, and it is a very hard place to get recovery because there's almost no network of support to do that, and when you do get linked into the system, you've got so many crappy providers. So I see a lot of people struggling. You also have a lot of inner city that have never been taught or allowed opportunity to learn other ways to deal with emotional turmoil, conflict, anger, crime and violence. And so we envisioned setting up a community art center that would do a series of art therapy classes using art in its broadest sense to help people to come up with healthier ways to deal with stress and anger and things like that. and also create a very large studio space with supplies where people could come in on their own and paint or throw pottery or have computers to write poetry, whatever it is that they could use as an outlet to start on that path of recovery. Since everything has happened, we're still doing all this. And the third thing we're adding in is a whole series of group meetings and counseling for the post-trauma piece. The post-trauma piece is phenomenal. I've had so many men that I've talked with that have said, I never in my life would have ever said that I would agree to talk to a therapist, but I got to tell you, my head is really messed up, and I probably should talk to someone. So a lot of people are suffering right now, and they're suffering needlessly, and they don't have any framework or support group that they can go and talk with, available to the community for free. If you have money, then you can afford to have certain services and care. But if you're at the community level and you don't have good health insurance or insurance that covers those things, then you're pretty much left to a system that's incredibly broken. So that's where we already have volunteers that are coming back to run the art therapy pieces and to run the group meetings and all that. We chose the name Prometheus because he's the Greek god who got in trouble for helping humans and then got punished his whole life for doing it. So we thought that was a very good analogy for us in terms of we are going to say the right thing and do the right thing, knowing that we're not going to build a lot of allies perhaps locally for a while because this is just not the way they do things here.
Right.
But it's got to happen. And we believe that as long as we have 51% support for what we're doing, we're fine, because someone's got to do it. And I've been so exasperated working with the federal groups in trying to get resources and help and models to bring in and use here that I gave up. And you know the group I've had the best response from?
Which?
I got on the Internet one day and spent a couple of hours and sent a set of emails out to various Vietnam vet groups. And I've had several groups in different parts of the United States email me back and say, what can we do to help? And they've put me in touch with some great people who are experts at post-trauma, some models, et cetera, so that we can – I don't want to reinvent the wheel, obviously.
Right, yeah.
But, you know, I can't believe our Office of Mental Health for the state of Louisiana, which has an annual budget of – like $370 million, hasn't brought in the team from New York City that developed all their post-trauma or hasn't gone and benchmarked. And that's one of the things about Louisiana that's very frustrating. They live in the past. They think from the past. They don't think beyond local. And what they think local turns into a lot of infighting, a lot of history, a lot of politics, a lot of favors, and it keeps us just locked down on not being able to develop at all. So I've been doing a lot of work with inmates, as I know you know. The last 10 years, they call me the corrections guru in the state of Louisiana. And whenever I've gone to AA meetings in New Orleans, almost everybody starts their opening with, when I was in prison. My estimates from a statistician standpoint is that probably one out of every three black men in the New Orleans area will be incarcerated at least once in their lifetime if they live in the state, which is a pretty phenomenal amount of people, especially considering no one will hire them, no one will give them social services. Women who come out, if they were in for a drug arrest, they don't qualify for TANF for up to 2 years. And you've got a large segment of a population that has just been forgotten, overlooked, set up for failure, basically. And that's a population that I've been working with and my colleagues, and that's a population that we're real committed to. Because you have a lot of good people. I always say some of the best men I've ever met are in prison right now.
Let me ask you a question, though, because we've been saying that a lot of the African-American population is not there, and yet a lot of the high-risk and at-risk youth, substance abuses, mental health, and formerly incarcerated individuals, as your perspective states, are part of who you're doing your outreach for, but have they come back yet?
Yes. You already had a very disenfranchised, under-the-radar population, and a lot of them, some of them were actually living here already without power. They're kind of used to it. Within our block area, we had two homes of folks that couldn't afford to pay for electricity, so they lived without. If you drive around at night in the ghost town areas, you'll find people sitting out on their porches. So there are definitely people back, without a doubt. Now, I don't think anyone else acknowledges this part of the population that is back, and they are trying to come back and live and work. But again, I'm not worried about finding clients. There are enough people back, and there are definitely people back that need these services.
How do they find out about what you're doing?
Probably like everything else, word of mouth. It's a combination of word of mouth, and we're not a very big area, and a lot of people know each other. And the joke is you never talk bad about someone to someone you don't know, because either they know them or they're related to them. That's how little degrees of separation we have here. And I've been saying this from day one. If the SPCA can get out to every single home in our region, not only just once, and every block here you see spray-painted messages from the SPCA. My favorite one was there's a house that completely got trashed and moved in the middle of a street during the hurricane, and they had spray-painted on the side of it, "One fish rescued." One fish rescued.
What does that mean?
It means that they rescued a fish out of that home. My statement being there were no people back, but SPCA came in and checked homes. They set up feeding stations at homes for animals that had not been evacuated out that were still living in the city. They've done more for our animals than they have for our people. And I'm not trashing SPCA. I'm just making the
actually complimenting them that they rose to the occasion,
right,
that they're organized enough to do this.
Right. But my question is, if they can do that, then what the hell is going on? Where is everybody else supposed to help with our human needs? If they can get around, and they put dates when they came by. Some homes have three different visits from the SPCA. One dog under house, one black cat in house. They left messages everywhere. If they can do that, then there is no reason after 4 months that FEMA could not have trailers for every single person that owned a home that wanted to be able to come back. And
they're still checking the homes, because I read in the paper yesterday that they even found another body after all this time, you know, while checking one of the homes that hadn't been gone through yet.
Right. Well, and one of the things, if you notice, they never talk about how many people are missing.
Mm-hmm.
And my colleagues estimate that between 5 and 10,000 people are missing, but they don't talk about that. The official death toll is a little over 1,000, but
right,
they are not talking about how many people are missing. And I will say one thing. After having gotten back to and having some friends move back and having had a chance to really sit down and talk to folks that I'm close with and that I know, everything that played out the first 72 hours across the nation in terms of what was happening is what happened.
What do you mean?
How many people died at the Superdome? They've covered everything up. When we finally filed our police report here in New Orleans, it took 3 months before we could file the report, because the insurance company has to have the report. The officer who came to do it ended up sitting down and talking with us for a while, and because of, you know, that's the way New Orleans is. If you're an insider, they'll talk with you. He was at the Superdome, and he, you know, we said the four deaths, he said absolutely not. He said it was at least 150 people. And he said that he, in moving from site to site, he passed dump trucks that were loaded with dead bodies that were going to be dumped. So there's
what do you mean going to be dumped?
Dumped in the river.
The dead bodies?
Yeah. And I've had that confirmed by several people. What happened on the ground here is completely been shut down. It's been completely spun, and there's a lot they're not talking about. But for those of us who live here, for those of us who have neighbors and best friends and colleagues that were here, we know what happened. And the Fed shut it down after about...
So you're saying, I mean, my mouth is falling open from what you just said, but I don't want to just gloss over it. You're saying that there's 5,000 to 10,000 people listed as missing, and that a lot of those people are dead and were in those trucks filled with bodies that were being dumped in the river?
It was a combination of things, but that was one, you know, I've had to...
And the river flows out to the ocean, so it was really their way of getting rid of these bodies and not counting them.
Exactly. And that's something that I think in years will come out, but it's just too political right now. But those of us that are here that have been back, and I drive around every day. I'm one of the few people that has spent probably an hour to 2 hours every day driving around this region and talking with people. And we've been documenting. We've taken over 2,000 pictures to document what's happened in the rebuild that they talk about. But my analysis at this point after 4 months is that everything that played out the first 72 hours is exactly as it happened. And then they started the cover-up after Bush came in the first time because they realized how out of control it was. The New Orleans airport was out of control. People got stranded there. People got stranded at different places. I mean, it was absolute mayhem. It was chaos. And, again, I keep coming back to it didn't have to be this way. There were a lot of things that could have been done, and there's still a lot of things that could have been done. I mean,
well, I know you as somebody who does speak her mind and really stands up for the truth, and that's something I've always loved and respected about you because it's the way, I mean, tell the truth faster. That's what this whole show is
and
about.
That's why I'm always in trouble.
You know, and are you putting yourself in any danger against a backlash of people who want to keep these things covered up?
Yes and no, but someone's got to speak out. Someone has to be willing to be on the ground here, and so much happened, and there's so many people from here that know what happened that I don't see it as I'm the only one exposing a huge cover-up.
Mm-hmm. Also, so there are others speaking up?
No. And part of it is that people are not connected. There is no formal information. You know, I have a theory, and this comes from living in the poorest country in the world when I was in West Africa, is if something's broken and it stays broken, it's not about it, the logic. It's about it's really working well for someone. New Orleans being broken historically has worked well for a lot of people. And I think now you have a perfect example of there's a lot of fear that this stuff is going to get out, and what's really happening and happened would show a completely different face of failures in this nation. And I'm not worried because every person I know that's back and living here has their own set of stories.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many of us, but I think part of keeping us all so disconnected and not helping us be able to return, I'm sure a lot of people are scared that if 200,000 people are back here and they start talking and those stories start getting documented, it's going to be some powerful stuff. So.
Wow. I mean, I'm floored. I mean, I know you've been keeping me updated in terms of a lot of this, but
Yeah. Even
hearing some of the stuff today that I hadn't heard from you before, I'm just like, you know, it's like my stomach is in a knot. I'm enraged and shocked and saddened.
Absolutely.
So if I'm feeling that just listening to it, I can just imagine, which is post-traumatic stress, but the rage and the shock and the sadness that those of you that are living there must be going through.
Right, and I don't want to take anything away from or try to speak on behalf of anything that happened in Vietnam, but I would say you have a lot of the same idea going on right now. A lot of people have been completely traumatized, have been through horrific experiences, and now it's as if there's no one here to help and there's no one to validate that, yeah, this happened. There was I don't know if you caught any of it, but on Capitol Hill, they flew up a few people to testify on behalf of New Orleans and what happened during the events. And these women were all rather caustic and rightfully so. But one of the comments one of the women said was the early days at the Superdome were equivalent to a concentration camp. And a very conservative Republican, forget who it was, but it doesn't matter, said to her, I take serious offense with you comparing that event with anything to do with a concentration camp. And the woman's comment was, if you put a pig in a dress, it's still a pig. And her reasons for making the parallel comparison was that what people don't know is that the National Guard was on the ground early on in the Superdome, and they separated the men from the women, and that's why children got separated from their parents. Mm-hmm. They separated the men from the women, and the first couple of days, they were running it that way, and then it broke into complete mayhem when people were saying, this is ridiculous. We have no food and water. This is crazy. And that's when it got real out of hand. It got just, you know, people were starving. People were dying. People were watching people die. And the other thing I have real trouble with is if you're not from here and you weren't here, it's real hard for us to hear outsiders talk about how bad our police force is, talk about animalistic behavior, talk about looting, talk about all those things, because they haven't been in this situation. They don't know what they would have done in the same situation. And people did things that they did because they were terrified, they were hopeless, they thought they were going to die, and people do. I mean, you look at wars and what happens when people are put in those situations. And there's no tolerance for any of the behavior, I think, that unfolded here. And we have a historical violence problem. You had a lot of people that, not a lot, I shouldn't use that term. You had some people that were drug addicts that stayed behind. They couldn't get fixes. They were jonesing. And one of the other things I've never heard anyone say besides me is you had a large segment of your black population in New Orleans does not know how to swim. They did not grow up with the luxury of neighborhood pools. So you had a lot of your inner city did not know how to swim. Can you imagine how terrifying it must have been to watch water come up past your first floor?
I can't imagine, no.
No.
That's just amazing.
Right, and for someone like me who grew up at the beach and I'm a strong swimmer, I'm sure it's easy for a lot of places to say, well, why don't they just swim? Well, you had a lot of people terrified of swimming. So I think there's so many factors that add into what happened, and none of them are getting enough play. I think, you know, 5 years down the road, all of this will come out, but it's not coming out right now. And in the meantime, we're living in hell.
What do you see as the future of New Orleans at this point? I mean, you're saying the other parish is basically rebuilding already and people are coming back. What do you see these elite committees ending up doing? And do you see people are going to come back?
I think they're talking now about, and I think what they're going to do is they're going to reduce the size of the parish. I think you'll probably see a city that comes back with maybe a half to three-fourths of the number of people it had before. I think you're going to see a lot of golf courses and parks in areas that they don't want to rebuild on. I think you're going to see a far more elite and boutique city. I think it's going to be far more like a San Francisco. And I think it's going to be based on politics, money, and our property developers that are already behind the scenes.
Which means more Republican, because New Orleans actually has been a bit more Democratic in Louisiana. And I think what you're saying also politically is that it's probably going to turn much more Republican.
Well, actually, the South already has. They just still call themselves Democrats. We have a Democratic governor who, if you look at her policies and actions, is exactly the same as a Republican. So there is not a whole lot of difference between the two anymore in the South. So what you've had in the South is a complete turnover to Republicanism, mm-hmm. and strong Bible Belt, et cetera. So I think there's a lot of deliberateness in controlling who's able to come back and how they come back and... you know, using the opportunity for what it can do. And it's horrific to watch. I've watched the U.S. do this in other countries, but to watch them do it in our own backyard to their own people, I expected a lot more.
Well, so, I mean, even with the earthquake in Pakistan and the tsunami in Asia, it seemed like things were, well, not... It hasn't been mobilized well enough for the earthquake in Pakistan, but the tsunami relief certainly is much more organized.
Absolutely, and one of the last things, and that I'm glad you raised that point, one of the things that has always shocked me, when the country I lived in went into a civil war, and when other countries experience natural disasters or wars, any of the nonprofits that are working there, both internally and externally, like USAID or someone, they stop whatever they're doing usually, whatever services they're providing. They come together, and they deal with the emergency. they deal with putting out the fire and then getting everyone stable and then trying to get everyone back into their life, whatever that kind of is, help with the rebuild. And when things reach closure back to where they were before is when they go back to doing the works they were doing before. So interestingly, in America, I can't tell you how disappointed and, excuse me, pissed off I am at the nonprofit sector in this country. They should be ashamed of themselves. The amount of money that they've raised on our behalf, and they're not here. They've not coordinated. They've not talked to each other. No one knows what the other one is doing, if anything. And I can tell you from being here, there's no one here. You drive street after street, and it's a ghost town. I don't know where all that money is. Where I think it probably is paying a lot of salaries. And the few people that I get calls all the time because I'm from here, not for work, but because they want me to give them directions or tell them about the community. But they don't want to hire people from here. So
they're hiring carpetbaggers, basically, to do the rebuilding.
Right. Well, and in terms of, like, being a trained professional, they're not hiring people like me. The feds just gave almost $70 million to United Methodist, I forget, congregations or something for case management in the United States. UM is not even a group from Louisiana, but they got this huge FEMA contract to do case management of Hurricane Katrina survivors. And none of us could really find out much about it to be able to be possibly brought in to help coordinate, et cetera, et cetera. So this is just another example of, you know, whatever relationship UM had that they got hooked in for, you know, 60-something million dollars to handle the case management. We have a lot of good people that were here, professionals, that want to come back, and they can't because there's no work for them in their trained professions. But yet other people in other parts of the United States are getting hired and snapped up immediately. And it's not that I haven't gone on the Internet and talked with any of the big organizations. I've been basically blown off by all of them, which I find, you know, whether it's, I'm not going to get into naming names, but the major nonprofits that have gotten funding awarded to them to be here on the ground helping us provide services and build an infrastructure are not here. And they don't want to talk to and work with any of us locals that are the trained professionals here. And
so what you're doing, as we said earlier, is doing your own nonprofit and trying to be a role model for what could be done. And that's called the Prometheus Group. And if people want to support Kira and the Prometheus Group with donations, they can. Their website's not quite up yet, if I understand it correctly, but it will be soon. And it's the www.prometheusgroup.org. And if the website's not up but you want to reach Kira, you could do it through my website, tellthetruthfaster.com. And if you want some people to hear this show who maybe won't believe some of the things we're hearing that you'll tell them, they can hear it in a few weeks straight from Kira's mouth. Again, it'll be up on the website in the archives. So go to tellthetruthfaster.com if you want to reach Kira right now, and prometheusgroup.org will be up and running in a few weeks, if I understand that correctly.
We're moving into our offices, opening the community center in January, and the website will be done by the end of next week.
Kira, I really want to thank you again, and what I'd like to do is in a few months have you back on and give us an update again.
Sure. By then I may have to move back to California because I've just been run out of the state.
Well, it would be California's gain if that happened. I know that. And I want to thank you, and I want to remind all my listeners that while you're celebrating Hanukkah and Christmas and Kwanzaa and having all this, remember that there are a lot of people out there who, through no fault of their own, are not having such merry holidays, and to think about donations directly to some of the organizations like the Prometheus Group that are on the ground in New Orleans rather than the national ones that really aren't getting some of the materials to where they need to go. So, Kira, thank you so much. As best as you can, I want you to have a Merry Christmas, and hopefully the new year will be better for everyone down there and for all of us.
Thanks, and it's perfect timing because it just started raining, so I have to go get all the buckets now.
Oh, no. Okay. And give my love to Derek, too, and Ethan.
Will do.
And thank you all for listening. I won't be back next week. KXAM is going to be doing some special Christmas music next Saturday, but I'll be back in 2 weeks with another show, Tell the Truth Faster, on KXAM 1310 AM in Phoenix. Everybody have great holidays and keep it safe. Thank you.